Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Johnny Tan, author of From My Mama's Kitchen, Food for the Soul, Recipes for Living. Welcome to my weekly From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio Show. My guest for this morning is award-winning author Eleanor Sullivan. Eleanor and I will be discussing her debut historical mystery novel set in 1830s in an Ohio village titled Cover Her Body. Good morning, Eleanor. Welcome to From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. How are you doing this morning?
I'm doing great, Johnny, and thank you for having me.
It is a pleasure having you on. Cover Her Body is an interesting read. It is an excellent book, and it gives a wonderful picture of how society conducted themselves some 200 years ago in America. So congratulations.
Thank you so much.
Let us start by getting to know you a little better. Please give us a quick walkthrough of your life from childhood to the present moment.
Okay. I married my high school sweetheart. And became a housewife and mother. 15 years and five children later, he was killed in an accident. And I had watched the nurse caring for him before his death, and I decided I wanted to be a nurse, even though people told me I had no money, too many kids, and I was too old. I did it anyway. Soon learned I wanted to teach nursing, and ended my nursing career as the dean of nursing at the University of Kansas. But about that time, I had to write a lot of books as part of my work as a professor and so forth. And so I love mysteries, and I thought my next career I would be writing mysteries. So that's what I've pursued since then.
Fantastic. You are living all your life in one lifetime.
I've lived several lives, and it's been an adventure, let's say. An adventure, that's what it's been.
Wonderful. When did you discover you like to write?
I think that took a long time. I had to write in graduate school, and then, of course, I started writing as a professor. And I think what really changed for me was when a business professor came to me. I was a professor in nursing, and he said, there's no good books on management in nursing. You know nursing. I know management. Let's write it. And that was 25 years ago, and I just finished, he's long gone from the project, but I just finished the 8th edition of that management book. It'll be out next week. So, and it was so satisfying to put something together and feel like I'm sharing it with other people. It's making a difference in not only nurses' lives, but in the patients they care for. So I think that really was the start of my loving writing.
It's interesting that because you, obviously, when you were growing up, I presume, you know, we do our normal English homework and so forth, and there was probably no one in your family that really actually is an author?
No. I can't think of anyone. My grandmother wrote wonderful letters, though, and I actually still have some of them from long ago.
Yeah.
And she was very expressive. We didn't live in the same town, and so she was very expressive in her letters. And she had been a nurse, so I always thought had she lived to see me be a nurse, she might have been proud, and maybe she'd been proud if she'd lived to see me be a writer. I don't know.
People don't write like the way your grandmother writes, though, anymore.
Well, probably not. Probably not. Well, and I always loved to read. And although my family, I didn't see many readers in my family, no one ever discouraged me from that. So I could go to the library and just, that, to me, that is still a thrill, to go to the library and get a bunch of books or order them. Now I order online, I'll have to admit, and just to have a new book in my hands, I just love it.
In reading your book, I mean, it's obvious that you put a lot of thought process, you're extremely creative in what you do. So as a child growing up and, of course, all your adult life, have you always had this sort of a daydreaming time that you kind of got away as an escape?
Actually, yes. That's very interesting. I've never had anyone ask me that question. But I have. I've always imagined something more. I mean, even when I had little children, I was always thinking, I wonder if I could learn to wallpaper. I wonder if I could refinish furniture or could I make a needlepoint picture? I did all those things. And I always wanted something more to be doing. And I guess I still do.
It just reminded me in reading your book and as we talked about Murder, She Wrote, Angela Lansbury, that kind of slew kind of thing, you know, and it's just interesting. So were you into a lot of those murder mystery kind of stuff?
Oh, yes, I still am. Law and Order was my favorite. And I know some of them are pretty formulaic. I have to admit,
right.
Murder, She Wrote is a little too much structure.
Right.
But I love the puzzle part, and I think I also love that in the end, almost always, the bad guy gets his comeuppance. Not like in real life, where things don't always turn out so well. But, yes, I have a, you know, I record lots of TV shows, and I love mystery movies and books. It's a lifelong love.
Wonderful. I used to read briefly Nancy Drew, and I remember this one time, for whatever reason, Miss Maple comes to mind.
Oh, yes. yes, that's right. Yes, I mean, Agatha Christie is our, you know, the mother of all mystery writers, I think. Because she really she laid it out. She laid the plots out. She didn't do much with characters.
Right.
These were pretty cardboard characters, but her plots were so wonderful. You know, you could replicate any of her plots today, and they would work.
So what influenced you in your stories that you write?
Well, certainly in the historical ones has been my family. But before that, I think it was reading a really good book and learning something and feeling like that was so important in my own development. It isn't just the words on the page. It's what you do with them inside, intellectually and emotionally even. And I think that's... You know, I wanted to do something like that. I hope that my writing could do that for someone else. I do get emails and letters from people who say that it's made a difference in their lives, and that's the most gratifying.
Wonderful. Well, you're very passionate in the way you write. So do you use your writing to express your feelings or just as an outlet from an entertainment perspective?
Oh, I think it's definitely my feelings. Yes, I think... Well, the character in Cover Her Body, Adelaide, she has doubts about her own faith. That is, and she lives in a very rigid, constricted community. And I think as she doubts, I've doubted. And the kinds of things she's concerned about, the wider world, that's my concern. I think a lot of my feelings come out, and certainly people I'm irritated with and don't like. they show up as antagonists or actually murderers. So I do have one character that's going to come to life in the second book, and he, although he's a man, I'm actually his character I'm fashioning on a distant relative that I hardly dislike. And so Peter is going to be a whining, victim, self-serving kind of person. And whenever I'm thinking of him, I think of her. So, yes, I guess it all comes out.
Why write a historical mystery novel?
Well, that certainly is because of my family. My grandmother took me and my sister to this little town, Zor, in Ohio, on several occasions in our childhood. And then I would go back a few times because the leader of that town historically was it's my fourth great-grandfather. And I'd just been fascinated by it. And so once I had written a few contemporary mysteries, I thought it was time I could, and I knew there'd be a lot of research to do, but I thought I could then craft a mystery that took place in that time and place, and that's what I did.
Wonderful. So what makes a good historical mystery novel?
I think you have to be really brought into the world. You have to, the story world has to become real. And, of course, I made it as historically accurate as I could. So even though the plot and most of the characters are fictitious, the world is as best we can know it was at that time. But I think you have to, and then you have to have compelling characters. Again, they can't be cardboard characters. Mm-hmm. They have to have real lives and real emotions and mm-hmm. real problems. And then, of course, the main thing you have to have in a historical mystery is a murder or some mm-hmm. sort of mystery, usually a murder. Mm-hmm. And you have to have a character become the sleuth, which my protagonist does. Mm-hmm. And then you have to have it solved by the end.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, I've not read any of your other books, but what is the inspiration behind Cover Her Body? I know you have a tremendous background in the medical field from a nursing perspective and so forth, but what is the inspiration behind Cover Her Body?
I think the, you know, nurses mm-hmm. didn't really become a profession until 1854 in the Crimean mm-hmm. War. Mm-hmm. And so this is before that, and so mm-hmm. there weren't, though there certainly there were women who nursed, there weren't nurses per se.
Right.
But the closest thing to a professional nurse would have been the midwife.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the thing that really inspired me was a book by Laurel Archer. She's a historian who wrote The Midwife's Tale. And what she did was she took an actual diary from a midwife in the late 18th century. And this woman was a midwife until her mid-70s
mm-hmm.
and had kept a diary almost daily of just, you know, went to Mrs. White, she was delivered of a fine baby boy, and then she'd tell the problems, or she said, our boat sunk in the river, and today I planted peas. And
mm-hmm.
Dr. Archer took those little vignettes out of that diary, and then she explained them. And put them in context for the time. I mean, the midwife's husband was in jail for a while in a debtor's prison, and
mm-hmm.
she explained some of that, and I got a sense of what the midwife's life was really like on a daily basis, and
mm-hmm.
that's really what inspired me, was to tell her story.
I don't think they have that many midwives all over America now anymore, is there?
Sadly, not. There are certainly in England,
yes,
midwives, and because for most births mm-hmm. that are natural, hospitalization and
mm-hmm.
a physician are not needed. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, in America, that has not been the prevailing view. But I'm hopeful that will change, because as reimbursement for healthcare changes in whatever
right.
form it is, we don't know. we're using way more nurse practitioners than in past days because,
mm-hmm.
again, there's very simple, common recurring chronic illnesses. Nurse practitioners are very appropriate. So I'd be hopeful we'll have more midwives. Nurse midwife, I would insist on being nurse midwives, because I think midwives need that medical background to know when they do need a physician in a hospital.
Right. How much research did you do before writing the book?
Oh, I did tons. I was just, as a former scientist, I was just
mm-hmm,
intent
mm-hmm.
that everything would be accurate. Fortunately, the Ohio Historical Society has wonderful resources. They're all online,
mm-hmm.
Primary sources. There's a dissertation from Ohio State that tells the whole story of these people known as the Separatists.
Right.
From their lives in Germany to the settlement. And then finally I met a historian who works in the town, or had worked in the town 30 years, and she's just sort of been at my beck and call for every little question. So, but what's really has been fun, though, is going out and finding people who are doing some of those crafts, we would call
mm-hmm.
them, that people
yeah.
back then called it their work. I mean, I went to meet a blacksmith and see
mm-hmm.
how he worked, and a woodworker
mm-hmm.
who doesn't use power tools. And right
mm-hmm.
now I'm taking a pottery class. And just getting my hands in the clay and feeling like what it was, that my work was just terribly amateurish. But that isn't the point. I mean, it'd be like something a school kid did. But nonetheless,
mm-hmm.
I'm getting the experience of what it would have been like to be a potter in that
mm-hmm.
day. So those are the fun parts. Next, I'm going to meet with a woman who braids rugs
mm-hmm.
and find out how that works.
Very, very interesting. Please give us a synopsis of the book.
Okay. In 1830s, in a strict religious village in northern Ohio, the midwife finds the body of a dairy maid in the river, and immediately she knows the girl did not drown. But her community is all too ready to think it was an accident, and she knows otherwise, and her questioning eventually brings the outside authorities, the people, the separatists had hated from their persecution in Germany, and but she doesn't give up, and eventually she puts her life in danger as she tracks down the killer.
How did you come up with the various characters?
I guess I just started building the story world, started with the midwife, and I wanted her to be married. I wanted her to have the struggles that a marriage entails, and to have her husband very different from her so that they could have that tension.
Mm-hmm.
And as a young woman would in that time, she had an infant. And then they actually built in this town, they built dormitories for the children, and when they were three, they went to the girls' or the boys' dormitory, where they never returned home again.
Mm-hmm.
And when they were 14, they would be assigned to apprentice with one of the workmen. And from all accounts, the matrons in those dorms were very harsh on the children.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wanted to show that. And so Adelaide had. Her sister has recently been let out of the dorm, and she was quite traumatized by it. And she's teaching her sister her herbal knowledge, and eventually will teach her to be a midwife.
Mm-hmm.
But the problems with her sister living with her and so forth. And then she has her mentor, Emma, who taught her midwifery, but sadly Emma now is blind. And lives alone, and she tends to Emma, but mostly relies on Emma for advice.
Mm-hmm.
And she has a good friend, and her husband are good friends. He's the blacksmith, and her friend Helga has a number of children and is very concerned about her youngest going to the dormitory.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then, of course, there's my ancestor, who was the leader.
Mm-hmm.
And from all accounts, he was very domineering. And that's pretty fun to write. He provides a nice tension with Adelaide because
mm-hmm.
they certainly
mm-hmm.
cross paths. And then his son Peter, who, as I said, would show up in the next book. From all accounts, he was a very hapless, unsuccessful man, and unlike his father. And in fact, the only thing we know about him is he was assigned to the chicken coop. So, and that's absolutely it. No one has it. But fortunate for me, he got married and had children because
mm-hmm.
they had a period of celibacy. These
mm-hmm.
these very practical Germans,
mm-hmm.
whenever when they needed the women to help right after they got there, I mean, they had to clear land and build buildings and start industries, and they didn't want the women getting pregnant and being weighed down by child rearing, and so
mm-hmm.
they just
mm-hmm.
someone just declared celibacy. And so, hard to believe. And even people were married, moved apart,
mm-hmm.
and men and women lived in different cabins and so forth.
Yeah.
But they built the Ohio Canal through their land, and when they got the money from that, they paid off their mortgage, and voila, marriage was again allowed, and my ancestor promptly got married.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
I think
mm-hmm.
actually he wanted to get married.
It
but
seems
we'll
that,
never know.
It seems that life is very pragmatic.
Very much so. And they're very, mm-hmm. yeah, I think that was probably his influence. It certainly it mm-hmm. came down through my grandmother. She was a very practical German woman,
mm-hmm.
stern in a way, but very loving.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they just, you know, whatever it is, you know, surviving in the early 1800s
right.
in the wilderness, a lot of people didn't make it, and so
mm-hmm.
I think, you know, that you had to be pretty strong and disciplined to really make it, and they turned out to be very successful and very prosperous, as a matter of fact.
Right. There's a sense of resiliency from within and also as a community and a family, and it's pretty much in the sense that the strongest, the toughest survives and continued on.
Mm-hmm. Well, as Darwin said, the survival
mm-hmm.
of the fittest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's hard. Some people have asked me why. Mm-hmm. In fact, my editor asked me on the, just reviewing the next manuscript, why would anyone live in Tor?
Yeah.
It was so strange. And I said, well, Lauren, you're coming from the world today, you know, where we expect freedom.
Yeah.
First of all, it was a different world, but also there were so many people who didn't survive.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
the wilderness was a harsh master.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. I think it was a survival, and also it was their religious beliefs. You know, they were Pietists.
Sure, sure.
And they believed that, and they believed that they helped each other by pointing out their faults.
Mm-hmm.
For which that was also harsh.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think they were very punishing. The only thing I know is that if you were accused of doing something wrong, you had to sit in the front at Sunday meeting and admit your sin.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know what happened after that. But they were quick to watch each other and criticize each other from all accounts. Which in a small community, you know, it'd be like a small
mm-hmm.
town today.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems like the greater good of the community outweighs the need of an individual.
Yes, you know, that's still today a mm-hmm. The tension between public good and individual rights.
Right.
Certainly in this country, we lean way far into individual rights, but that's
right.
not always true, not certainly true in other societies.
Mm-hmm.
And even in that day and age, I think that was much more true as
mm-hmm.
well. But they definitely opted for the good of the community.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I think I'll go out on a limb to say this because I'm not sure. In Germany, even today, because I've talked to people from there, there is a stronger belief that the public good supersedes the individual.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm taking a chance. That may not be actually accurate, but
mm-hmm.
I kind of got that sense.
Mm-hmm. Do you use real people, or are all your characters are your creation?
Well, up until this book, I've always created characters out of my imagination. You
mm-hmm.
know, there might be someone inspired me, like the midwife
right.
in the book, but. This time I had to include my ancestor because he was their leader, and if there's a murder in town or a suspicious death, he would be involved.
Right.
And I felt sort of awkward doing it. It was like I was sort of violating his privacy or something. I mean, you know, and there's a lot of descendants. I'm only one of hundreds of descendants. In fact, a lot of us have met up online and through Ancestry
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
so forth, but... you know, and I think, well, would they be offended?
Right.
He doesn't do anything bad. He's just he just knows what's right, and he tells everyone. But
mm-hmm.
but other than that, and then how I'm going to portray how Peter's going to act in the next book, everyone else, of course, is my own creation.
Mm-hmm. What is the greatest challenge in writing the book?
I think it's when my editor criticizes me. That has always been a challenge in my writing, and it happens
mm-hmm.
every single book. It doesn't matter if it's nonfiction or fiction.
Yeah.
Prentice Hall sends out my nonfiction books for nurses out to reviewers, and they send back
mm-hmm.
their comments, and I just go, ouch, ouch, ouch. And I think, well, they don't understand me. They didn't get it. And then I settle down and I think, well, if an editor or a reviewer didn't get it, then I'm not making it clear. But I always have to give myself that talk. And I just, you know, when I see the email
mm-hmm.
come through, here's the review. And because at the time I think, oh, I've got it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I get shot down. But I think getting shot down is exactly what I need. And I think all my books get better for it. But it's still, maybe someday I'll get over that and say, oh, okay.
You're just being human, so that's natural.
That's
for you to
right.
take it a little
Nobody
personal.
Does. You know, I think that's what people, how people don't get published.
Yeah.
Is that when something like that happens, that they just give it up. I've
mm-hmm.
I've had a number of people say to me, well, I tried to write a book, and then an editor saw it, and he said this, and I just gave it up. And so I think that's the difference. that, mm-hmm. that you have to accept that that's how you're going to feel, and then, as you say, being human, and then just use it. Use it. Mm-hmm. I mean, these people, you know, are paid for a reason.
Get a piñata, beat the crap out of piñata, or write that character in and kill that character in
Ooh,
your book.
Ooh, good idea. Good idea. Kill him.
After all, you have the freedom of expression, you know? Introduce
That's
a character
right.
in that.
That's right. Well, it has to make sense, though. You can't just kill people willy-nilly. Well, I guess you can if you're a serial killer, but I don't read those kind of books, and I don't write them, but...
What would they say? Collateral damage?
Yeah, that's right. There's a... I think they did have shotguns in that day and age.
There you go. Yeah, you know, it's like a stray bullet, you know, a stray pellet.
Oh, yes, it was an accident. Bang, bang, bang.
That's right. What was the most interesting information you uncovered while doing your research?
Oh, it just happened today, this morning.
Mm-hmm.
I got this. Well, I post on my blog. I tell about the history of the 19th century, various things on my blog.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like medical care in the 19th right. century or crime and punishment then. So I did one on my ancestor, Joseph, that I wrote about in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I'm going to start tracing my ancestors one at a time. We'll start with Joseph.
Mm-hmm.
So I wrote in there, we don't know much about his early life in Germany. And that was one part. And then I also said when he came to America, he left his 14-year-old daughter behind in Germany and brought mm-hmm. his son Peter. We don't know why he left her behind.
Mm-hmm.
And we know she got married. And then, she married a man who was considered illegitimate.
Mm-hmm.
And she didn't get married till she was 27. She died when she was 42. Well, why was she so old when she got married was mm-hmm. one question I posed. And why had she married a man illegitimate? She actually herself was born 5 months after her parents got married. So
mm-hmm.
and that, I think, was a big thing back then.
Right.
So I get this comment from this historian in Germany
mm-hmm.
this morning.
Mm-hmm.
And he said to me, we do know a lot about Joseph's early days. I wrote about him in my dissertation published in 2003.
Wow.
And then he told me a few things, and then he went to the part about, he posted another comment. I'm just getting ready. I've got to mm-hmm. email him back. He said, why she waited so long to get married? First of all, she was very poor, and she had this bad reputation because her father was this separatist, which
mm-hmm.
meant he was a bad citizen. He wouldn't mm-hmm. follow the mm-hmm. state religion.
Right.
And so she was probably lucky to find anyone at age 27 to marry, because after 30, it was unlikely anyone would get married.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So isn't it? Well, I think it's interesting.
It
I'm
is.
I'm so happy I heard from him, and I'm going to email him back in a few minutes. So there have been a lot of other interesting things I was thinking about. Well, when this
mm-hmm.
came through this morning, I thought, I just have to tell you this.
How much of you is in the book?
Oh, gosh, it must be me a lot. But my stories are probably a little darker than I feel like I am as a person. And
mm-hmm.
There was another author who had offered to review my book. So she's very multi-published and would give me a nice quote. Several of my
mm-hmm.
author friends agreed to do that
mm-hmm.
and did. But this woman said she started into it, and she got about a quarter of the way in, and she could not read it. She said, it's just too upsetting for me to read
mm-hmm.
it.
Mm-hmm.
She writes very lighthearted mysteries,
right.
which I think are delightful, but not what I write. And
right.
I actually thought that was a compliment. I wanted to use her quote, but of course you didn't
yeah.
want to. I mean, I didn't even ask her. So I think, you know, I'm generally an optimist and pretty upbeat, and but my stories don't sound that way. So
mm-hmm.
I don't know why. I don't, it's never, I just write the way it seems to be right for me. So it's kind of interesting.
Very interesting. So which character do you identify most with in the book?
Oh, definitely Adelaide, the midwife.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, when she goes about attending to her patients,
Yeah.
And she has a very irascible woman in the mm-hmm. second book.
Mm-hmm.
And she just is about to lose her temper. The woman won't take her medicine. She keeps getting worse. She won't listen to her. And I certainly understand that feeling with non-compliant patients. And then just gathering her herbs, growing them, preparing mm-hmm. them. There's just, I have such a wonderful sense of that experience, what that must be like. Of course, nothing like what I ever did.
Mm-hmm.
I have found an herbalist in Minneapolis. I'm going to possibly be in touch with her and try to go and see how she does it. But that, and then, of course, I have 5 children and now 8 grandchildren, and so... Mm-hmm. Having children and delivering them and all of that is just, I think, a thrill.
Mm-hmm.
So she gets excited when she sees a new baby born and all goes well. And so, I think, and her relationship with her husband and her own baby, whom
mm-hmm.
she just adores.
Mm-hmm.
So, I feel more. I mean, I'm not as good a person as she is. She's much nicer in a way and, cuter.
Uh-huh.
Maybe smarter. I don't know. She's sort of like my best self, if I can make myself into that.
There you go. And what's interesting also is that you're a woman of very strong character and commanding presence. And in reading her character, she's obviously have that sense of presence, of being in charge and being confident within herself in some ways. Of course, we all have our insecurities, don't get me wrong. Mm. But there's a sense of confidence, exuding what's right is right.
Mm, that's an interesting observation.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I feel that that's what she's like.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, you saw that in the book that she has some doubts. And
mm-hmm.
she has some temptations
mm-hmm.
that appall her, that she
mm-hmm.
has feeling the sense of doing something wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And she also likes to get away from her community and have some solitude.
Precisely. Mm-hmm.
And that's verboten there, too. Mm-hmm. They're meant mm-hmm. to be together is the idea. Is
right.
Watch each other all the time. So that's interesting.
Yeah, it's the development of, being together as part of security and then being alone is to have a sense of discovery of one's self-confidence in looking at life from a different perspective and saying, hey, I am capable of doing these things and I have the strength within me to be able to know ultimately right versus wrong, and I'm in pursuit of what's right.
I'm not sure she's quite that certain of it.
Mm-hmm.
I think she struggles with that.
Mm-hmm.
She wants to feel that it's right, but some of her contemplation is, this isn't going so well, and am I doing anything wrong, and should I do something different? And, right at the start, she's upset because she'd argued with her husband. And she couldn't just sort of let go of that. And I think that's true for all of us. If something
right.
happens between people,
mm-hmm.
why you feel badly about it, and sometimes you feel angry about it, and you want to tell them off, and sometimes you do, and that makes it worse. And so, I think she's just a very human person just struggling, but she is trying, and maybe
mm-hmm.
that's the difference that some people
mm-hmm.
in that community and in the world today
mm-hmm.
have no interest in improving their functioning or improving their relationship or improving themselves, and I think she does. She wants to get better all the time.
Right, and that's what I was alluding to in the sense that we all live in a structured, governed environment. Of course, it's much less now, say, versus then, but at the same time, there's a sense of each of us has this sense of individuality.
We do.
And that's the exciting part because, she's thinking about this, and like you're saying, self-doubt creeps in. Am I way off in the left field?
Right, because she's so different from her community.
Precisely.
Right.
And her flavor, her character in talking with you, I realized that this is part of you because of the challenges and the adventures that you've gone through within your life.
Well, thank you. I hadn't actually put that together.
And you express yourself in your writings, whether it's consciously or subconsciously.
Yes, I'm sure I do. And mm-hmm. and the qualities that I would, my better qualities, I want them to come out mm-hmm. in my mm-hmm. character. And my lesser qualities we'll just probably not hear much about. But so, you're just seeing the good parts. I think there'd be some of my family members would tell you a few other things, but but it's fun to, I think, explore her mm-hmm. and in a way explore myself. Yeah, mm-hmm. It's fun, and who doesn't want to think about themselves?
That's right. Well, I mean, you're sprinkling a little bit of yourself in each one of the various characters, though.
Well, yes, of course. Yes, you're right. Sure. Mm-hmm. I like the wise woman, mm-hmm. Emma. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I like to think I have that role with some of my family members.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's times when I might be hesitant and wanting to follow all the rules mm-hmm. like her husband Benjamin does.
Mm-hmm.
And he wants to keep them safe because in actuality, there was a man banned from the community, and because they were communal, when mm-hmm. if anyone was sent away, they could only take literally the clothes on their back, or maybe mm-hmm. a few mm-hmm. pieces of clothing, because everything was owned by the society.
Mm-hmm.
And this man was caught keeping some money to himself, and he was thrown out. Mm-hmm. And his family was told they could stay, but they didn't. His wife and children went with him. And in later days, he sued the society and mm-hmm. eventually lost in the state court.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it went to appeals court and the state Supreme Court. And the historian gave me a full account of that. And she wrote mm-hmm. an article about it. But so if they would be banished, there would be Benjamin with his wife and baby and her sister, and then what would they do?
Mm-hmm.
Even though they both were talented, he was the cabinet maker and she was the midwife, but it would have been very hard, and he was afraid of that because his own background in Germany, his parents and brother had been arrested because they were separatists, which is actually what did happen. And he never saw them again. And he was just wandering the countryside mm-hmm. trying to scrounge for food when this older man found him and took him home to his family, and then he moved to Zor with that family. So he had very real fears about trying to provide for his family or being unable to provide for his family.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, and we've all had times when we've been really worried about
right.
our finances and all of that. Most right. people have been through times like that. So
Right. Very true. What kind of feedback have you received from the people of Zor?
Oh, they love it. They were thrilled. Even when I was there on a research trip several years ago, taking pictures mm-hmm. and working in the library and
mm-hmm.
copying
mm-hmm.
documents and so forth, I mean, people all over the town were just saying, oh, that you're writing about it. Oh, my goodness. And so then when the book came out, they invited me there. They had a big event. They had, 100 people came. People mm-hmm. came who were descendants.
Yeah.
One very elderly man came. He was very hard of hearing, and so I said something about the historian wanted me to tell everyone there had never been a murder in Zor.
Mm-hmm.
And she said she was very worried that this account would get out there and people would believe it. And I said it's fiction, but nonetheless. And so when I said that, this man's apparently granddaughter or someone mm-hmm. turned to him and said, very loudly, was there ever a murder in Zor? And this man nods his head and says, yes. And everybody's just looking at him. And she says, when was that? Mm-hmm. And he said, after the war in mm-hmm. the tavern. And mm-hmm. so that would have been way later than my story.
Yeah.
So I said, ooh, that was close. So I see people people are correcting me all around, even from Germany. They're correcting me.
What he should have said was, "Read the book."
That's right. Oh, yeah. Well, they were great. And in fact, in September, I'm traveling with a group from Zohar. Some are descendants and some are just people very interested in it. Mm-hmm. And we're going back to Germany and we're going to visit all these little towns where the people came from, where they were imprisoned, where they were forced to do hard labor. And we're going to meet with some German historians and learn a lot more about their lives then. And I'm just fascinated by that. I can't wait.
Well, that's interesting because you did talk about, I mean, how they got out of Germany with the help of the Quakers in England.
Yes, they did.
So it's quite interesting because back then, even though each had their own sort of community, but they were helping each other because they were putting their trust in God, obviously, and were helping fellow men, fellow brothers, so to speak.
Right, and the Quakers and the Separatists had a lot in common in terms of their beliefs, mm-hmm. or so they thought. They got on the ship, they went in steerage, which of course was just horrible conditions, and they got to, it took 90 days, they got to Philadelphia, actually a little longer, they left in April of 1817, mm-hmm. they got to Philadelphia in August. And again, Quakers there then helped them, and eventually helped them meet someone who had land for sale in Ohio, and that's how they bought their land. But it wasn't just 1 year later that the Quakers and the Separatists had a falling out. Mm-hmm. And I found this letter from a Quaker woman written in 1818, and she's admonishing her fellow Quakers to not listen to Joseph Beimler anymore, mm-hmm. that he has them all fooled. He thinks, he has them sort of hypnotized. That's mm-hmm. the word she used, was hypnotized. They think he's another Moses. Mm-hmm. And so it was very interesting. It told me a lot about his character right then. And so they did have a falling out, and there were other Pietist groups, and they had differences too. The Separatists, during the time they were celibate, met with some group, and I'm going to get some of this mixed up because I don't have it in front of me, but the Separatists didn't eat pork. Mm-hmm. And so they made fun of them for that, and they made fun of them because, you know, where do you think you're going to have more Separatists born, and so mm-hmm. forth. Much like the Shakers were criticized, and of course it was true for them because they mm-hmm. never changed their rule for celibacy, and, mm-hmm. and of course it's more or less died out. I think there's a few left in New England, but mm-hmm. But yeah, some of these groups, they kind of thought they were all alike, but then when it got down to the nitty gritty, and they got egos, you know, mm-hmm. those mm-hmm. leaders had, I'm sure, giant egos. See, now there's a bad quality of mine coming through. I like it when Joseph tells everyone what to do. I say, yes, I would know what everyone should do also.
It's in the genes. It's, you know, it's
in
passed
my
down
genes.
Several
I can't
generations.
Help it. That's what I'm going to tell people.
How is Zohar today compared to what you describe in the book?
Actually, it's amazingly similar. The very cabin that my ancestor built in 1817 mm-hmm. is still standing, and someone is living in it.
Fantastic.
Yeah, isn't that amazing? And unlike places like Williamsburg, where a lot of the original buildings were torn down and rebuilt
right.
in the likeness,
right.
same likeness, but these buildings, so many of them, have been maintained or at least restored as the actual building.
Yeah.
And so there's still a tin shop with a man who works in there. There's a bakery, and a woman has the bakery. Now, I guess there's not a dairy per se. There are no cows that they're actually milking. And they have a store, and they had a store back then, although it's in a different building. Back then they called it the magazine. And in it were all the things that the trustees would buy on their trips to the city. that they couldn't make. I mean, they made everything they could, but they bought coffee and tea and spices and some fabrics they bought. Most of those, of course, they spun and wove and knitted. And there's a garden that is exactly to the same as it was, with the herbs growing where they did and the flowers. And they have this garden is so interesting. It's an acre square, and in the center is a tall, I don't know, maybe blue spruce. I can't remember. A tall tree. And then around it are 12 junipers, and those represent Christ and the 12 disciples. And then there are straight paths that go into the center, and those are the paths of righteousness. And then there are side paths that connect those diagonal paths that connect the side paths. And those intersecting paths are how easy it is to get off the path of righteousness.
Very interesting. Wow.
Isn't that something?
Yeah.
And they still have the flower bed. They raise a lot of flowers. They love flowers. They live very plain and simple lives, but they really enjoyed flowers. And then, of course, the herbs. And then they built a greenhouse, and in it they raise lemons and lemon trees and orange trees. You know, back before they knew that citrus fruit kept people from getting scurvy, they had lemons and oranges in the wintertime. And that's where they, you know, would build, raise seedlings and so forth. And that's still being used for that purpose. So
interesting. Yeah.
It is interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Very much so. Kava Habati speaks about the lifestyle some 200 years ago, where people, like today, desire to be free, but yet being governed by man-made rules laced with strict religious beliefs. What life's lessons were you trying to impart in writing your novel?
I think that how similar we all are. That certainly the life situation was very different. The way they lived and worked was very different, but that the people were the same. That they had the same hopes and dreams and jealousies and envy and anger and love and tenderness. They had all those experiences just like we did. And one of the things people said in Zohar, what they said when I was there was, you know, so someone said, I've been a tour guide here for many years. And, you know, we go into the bakery or we go into the blacksmith shop and we explain how they did this or the wagon shop or whatever. And she said, I never thought about the people and how, what their lives were like living in here. And I never thought that they were like us. And that's what she had learned from the story. So
yeah,
what I wanted to have happen.
That's wonderful. So what would you like your readers to gain in reading Kava Habati?
Well, I think that was it. And to appreciate our heritage. This is this is America's heritage. This is what, without people who came here and braved the wilderness, we wouldn't have the lives we have today. And so I think it's an appreciation for that life and appreciation for those people. You know, when they left Germany, like many immigrants who came to this country in the early years, they knew they would never be going back.
Right.
And that's what was so appalling to me, to think about Joseph leaving his daughter there. She was only 14. You know, we can't imagine leaving a 14-year-old child behind somewhere where we'd never see them again.
Right.
But that they had the courage of their convictions, and they, you know, they could have acquiesced and gone to the Lutheran church and sent their schools to the Lutheran schools, the state religion. And of course, they were also pacifists, so they would have had to fight for the local prince. But they didn't. They had, their beliefs were so strong that they were willing, and their desire for freedom, surely, that played into it, I don't know. That they were willing to do whatever they had to do to get here. And I have a great appreciation for them. And, of course, if they hadn't, I'd be speaking German today.
Very true. So where can someone go to buy your book, get more information about you, and keep up with your latest happenings?
The best way is my website, Johnny, eleanorsullivan.com. And Eleanor is spelled E-L-E-A-N-O-R. And Sullivan is S-U-L-L-I-V-A-N. It's easy to order. There's links on my website to both the print book and the e-book, either through Amazon or Barnes & Noble. And, of course, any bookstore can order it if they don't have it. And, in fact, on my website, there is the first chapter is absolutely free.
Wonderful.
So if anyone wants to read the first chapter and see if they're interested, to just click on Cover Her Body.
Wonderful.
And they can find it.
Wonderful. How has writing this particular book impacted you personally?
I think it's made me come to appreciate not only my ancestors, but all of us who have, all of our ancestors, all of us. Doesn't matter what part of the world you're from or where you live, our ancestors have such an influence on our life that we don't even realize. You know, wherever they were, wherever they settled, we probably grew up near there. You know, they affected where our parents lived and where we lived and our experiences, how they raised their families. My grandmother spoke of a really strict upbringing. The youngest of six children and very strict parents. And I'm sure that affected how she raised my mother and how my mother raised me and how I raised my children. And I think it's just an appreciation, which even though I had some, knew our history a little bit and had, knew a few other descendants and so forth, it just didn't dawn on me how much our very lives are affected by people we never even knew.
It's true. And the sense of character was very strong because you mentioned just now about making those decisions, very tough decisions. First and foremost, the trip itself takes about 3 months. And then knowing that we're not talking about emailing each other.
No, we're not.
And even to send a letter, God knows, I mean, it takes forever to get from one end of the earth to the other side of the earth. And so it's just unthinkable.
It is. It is. And I'm hoping on this trip when we meet with the people there to learn more about how that happened. There must have been a Quaker that, you know, somehow these people connected with the Quakers. And there weren't many Quakers, I don't think, in Germany. But apparently there were some. And they must have gotten the word and someone must have written a letter 2 months later to England. And then they would have written back. I don't know. I'm hoping to learn more about that. But you're right. It's just even to set up the trip. And then to make it, and then to get to Philadelphia and not know what would happen to them then. And you know what? They knew very little about the what was known as the New World or America at that time. It hadn't been all that long that America had become a country.
Right.
So, and we just had the War of 1812, and so, and only 5 years later, and here they come. So, yeah, I think it's just it's very interesting to think about what that must have been like.
By the way, we're coming close to the end of the show. Do you have a recipe for living you would like to share with our listeners this morning?
Well, I think it's come through everything I've done, and that is follow your passion. I think whatever it is, no matter when people tell you you can't, when I wanted to be a nurse, my friend said, you're too old, you have too many kids, and you don't have any money. And when I wanted to quit my job and write mysteries, my friend told me, you're too old. You have a good job and you'll never make any money. Well, they were right about two out of the three, but I wasn't too old. So I think whatever it is, whether it's something small, like when I wanted to learn to hang wallpaper, or whether it's something major, like to write a book, whatever it is, I think that's it. This is my motto and my recipe for life, and one I can't imagine ever not having.
Wonderful. What can we expect from you during the second half of this year?
Well, I'm hoping to finish. Actually, if anyone listening is a nurse, I have two nursing books out. One came out in January called Becoming Influential. a guide for nurses, and a management book that would help any nurse is coming out next week, both from Prentice Hall. I will be finishing, I hope, by the end of the year, the second book in this series, Graven Images, and hope that it will be, and it should be out mid to late next year.
Interesting. And you mentioned something about how to be influential as a nurse?
Yes.
I would think if you have the shrink in your hand, you're in control.
Really?
Yes. I don't think the patient would give you a tough time about that.
Well, they'll have to read the book find out.
I'm just kidding.
I know you are.
I just have to say that because, like, when I show up, you know, it's like, okay, yes, tell me exactly what you want me to do. That's wonderful. So you are still writing wonderful articles about nursing.
I am, and I'm kind of amazed that they keep asking me to write books, but when they say, would you be interested in doing this, and I say, yes, and so then I write a proposal, and they just say,
yeah.
Okay. So, yeah, I because I'm not working in the field, but I do have a great research assistant for my nursing work. Mm-hmm. And that not only does the literature searches, but she knows what's going on in the field right now. Mm-hmm. And she has lots of examples, and so we can populate the book with those, and students really, nurses really like that. So it's working out.
You're a blessed human being, so that's wonderful. Any final thoughts about Cover Her Body?
I think people would be very surprised to read it and to learn about this world and how people live then. I think it would be a delightful adventure for anyone who wants to read it. And it's not too, there's not too much on the scene, any violence, on the page violence, but there's enough to make it interesting. So I hope they get to read it.
It is a wonderful read. You are very detailed. It gives a wonderful picture of story in the sense that you can really dive into the scene. And I think that's what's important because, like you had mentioned before, you draw people into the scene and so forth. And being able to live the life how they live at that time, I think that's very, very important. So it's very powerful from that perspective.
Oh, thank you very much. That's what I was hoping to do. And it's so nice, very gratifying to hear that you found that to be the case.
Yes, very nicely done. Eleanor, thank you for the great recipe for living that you shared with us just now and for spending this hour with me on From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. To all our listeners, thank you for being with us. Please join me next Tuesday morning. My guest will be New York Times bestselling author Heather Graham. Heather and I will be discussing about her latest novel titled The Unholy. We will also talk about what is behind America's fascination with the paranormal. For additional information about this show and future shows, please go to FromMyMamasKitchen.com. Thank you for listening and have a great week. Eleanor, thank you again and have a great day.
Thank you for having me, Johnny.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.